Welcome to the Catskills Renaissance, a show that aims to introduce you to all that is unique and interesting in this incredibly beautiful and relatively unspoiled area of New York State. My name is Rio, and my co-host is Lee Criso. And for our premiere show, we're privileged to have, as a guest, Laura Silverman, a writer, branding consultant, and the founding naturalist of the Outside Institute. That's right, the Outside Institute. Laura is a regular contributor to Edible Hudson Valley, The River Reporter, and WJFF. Through the Outside Institute, Laura hopes to inspire passionate stewardship of the land by nurturing humanity's powers of observation and innate affinity for all living things. Welcome to our show, Laura.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Great. So I was on your website, and I have to say it's just beautifully done. There's quotes, there's gorgeous photos, and everything.
And your picture too.
And a beautiful picture of you. And everything I saw there resonates with me because I'm a farmer, so everything that has to do with nature is my passion too. Tell us about the Outside Institute, which you founded in 2017. How did it come about?
Well, it came about because after about 10 years of living full-time in Sullivan County, after having moved up from New York City, I became aware that there was a real profound disconnection between even the people that had been living in this area for a long time, but especially with weekenders and people that were coming up from the city. They didn't really know how to be outside. I sensed there was a desire, but even people from this area didn't really know where to go hiking, didn't really know what plants and animals they were seeing when they were outside. And I felt like there was a real opportunity to help people get back to nature, if you will, and really find their place again in the wild.
Did you know in New York City, did you know a fellow by the name of Wild Man Steve, by any chance, or hear of him?
I don't know him, but yes, he's
notorious.
He's notorious, yeah. Sure.
What do you do in the Outside Institute? Do you have classes, courses?
Yeah, primarily I lead guided nature walks, but I also do teach people more specifically about foraging. We do some wildcrafting workshops, teaching people how to work with plants, herbal medicine, natural cosmetics, that kind of thing. And we also do slower, more mindful experiences called forest bathing. That's really just about learning to engage the senses and relax and connect to the forest.
You know, I find that at my farm, like I have some areas with herbs, like let's say rosemary or lavender. Mm-hmm. And if you take a chair and sit right in there, it's like you're getting the essence of that. So is that what you're saying with the forest?
Forest bathing.
Yeah, in a sense, it is like that. And actually, you know, there's been a lot of science around this that shows that the plants and trees emit these chemical compounds called phytoncides that are actually super stress relieving for us. And they even will lower your blood pressure and lower your cholesterol and improve your mood and all this. So,
but you better get your bug spray on first.
That's for sure. So yeah, just being outside, even without doing much, is healing and really beneficial for us.
Right. What does it emit again? Phytoncides?
Phytoncides, yeah.
Phytoncides.
Mm-hmm. Oh. They're actually chemicals that plants produce to help protect them from stressors and predators, and so that's beneficial for us when we absorb them.
So when we're out in nature, we breathe them in, or our body pours, do we absorb it through our body?
Yeah, all of that.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, that explains why my partner Lee can't get me out of the garden. Wouldn't you say, Lee?
I would say that's a good hypothesis there.
It's pretty addictive. There was actually an article that came out in the paper a few weeks ago. So many people sent it to me saying that scientists had determined the exact amount that you needed to spend outside every week in order to get the maximum benefit from nature, and that it was 2 hours, and that if you spent more than 2 hours, you didn't get any increased benefit. And it really kind of made me angry because I just don't really understand how they can arrive at such a number. But I was reading through the comments. It was on the New York Times, actually, and I like to read the comments there because people always have interesting things to say. And one guy chimed in, yeah, you can start with 2 hours, but I think it's gonna just be the beginning for you because it's pretty good dope. So I think it's true. It's addictive.
And it is.
The more you're outside, the more you want to be outside.
Well, that's for me, but I can't encourage. My partner doesn't seem to speak. Why don't you want to be outside?
Well, I do like being outside, but I don't know. I guess this time of the year there are a lot of insects around that seem to love me.
They love me too, but there's ways around that, and I find that, you know, ticks and Lyme disease and spiders and biting flies and all that can't really deter me from the great joys of being outside.
Well, speaking of the great joys of being outside, I want to ask you if you've come across something here. In the city, Rio and I used to once in a while take walks with this, I mentioned, wild man Steve, who goes through the different parks in New York City and gets arrested from time to time for doing that. But he points out a lot of interesting things. And on one excursion, we came across some mushrooms. And you got to be careful, obviously, with mushrooms. But he called them chicken mushrooms, and they actually taste just like chicken.
Yeah.
Have you come across them?
Of course, chicken of the woods.
Oh, and have you found them up here?
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's one right across the street at my friend Laquita's house on an oak tree. Every year she calls me, chicken's up.
Oh, okay. I'm going on the next tour.
Well, it was funny because when we went on that walk, you know, well, we're primarily into raw food, so we don't cook that much. But the wild man said, you have to cook this one. So we had a nice big chunk when we got home, and I said, Lee, I'm gonna saute this. And he says, I'm not eating that. So I went in the kitchen, I sauteed it, and everything came up and started eating in front of him. I said, hey, you know what? This really does taste like what we remember chicken to taste like. And finally he fell in.
It's the texture, really, that's pretty similar to chicken. Yeah. But yeah, you do have to cook most mushrooms, and you do have to be really careful because there are a number of toxic mushrooms out there. So
they might be lookalikes, right?
The chicken mushroom doesn't really have too many toxic lookalikes, actually, so that's a pretty safe one. And in fact, a lot of the good edibles are pretty singular and don't really have any toxic lookalikes. But nevertheless, you know, I recommend having a great guidebook, and more than that, going out with somebody who can be a mentor to you and help you learn.
Right, and don't fool around with the mushrooms unless you have a liver donor standing by.
Right, well, everything's edible once, as we say.
Yes.
So on your nature walks, do you do the nature walks year-round here or only during the season?
Yeah, year-round.
Year-round.
There's a lot to see in the winter. My teacher, Richard Mandelbaum of the Arbor Vitae Traditional School of Herbalism in New York City, will often do a walk for us in the winter, a winter tree ID, where you can learn how to identify trees by looking at their bark and their bud formation. Really interesting.
Oh, wow.
And certain ferns are still out in the winter, and definitely all the conifers. You can make pine needle tea, hemlock tea. There's a lot to do in the winter.
Oh, I'm going to ask you a question that I've been pondering. I saw with my pine trees that at a certain time of year, I see like the pollen flying out. So how can I capture this pollen from the pine trees?
Yeah, you can capture it. That's usually late spring, I would say.
May, June?
May, I guess. It really depends. This year everything was a bit late because it was so cold. But the pine pollen is actually high in testosterone, which is good for post and perimenopausal women. So you can, it's a little bit challenging to capture, but you need to just get a Tupperware or like a milk carton with a top cut off and go and tap on the flowers that are releasing the pollen.
Really?
That's all you do. Oh. Yeah, it's pretty time consuming. I have a little jar in my freezer, actually.
Oh. So you have to tap on it. Is it the cone? Is it the cone or something before the cone?
No, it's not the cone. So there's male and female flowers. The female flower is the cone, and the male flower is smaller. You'll see it. When you see the pollen wafting off the trees, just take a closer look, and they're little short male flowers. And you tap it off that.
What do they look like? Are they yellow or do they have a color?
Yeah, they're sort of golden brown. They're long and they're sort of almost soft, and they're in a little cluster.
Oh, I'll have to.
Yeah.
Now you see, audience, this is why you need a guide out there, because I've had these pine trees for years and I've never looked for this, what she's talking about.
Yeah.
You need a guide to point out all these wonderful things.
Well, you also just need to, I mean, a big part of what we try to teach people, and I think you mentioned it in your introduction, is to just hone their powers of observation, because that's really what it's about, learning about the natural world, is to slow down and really look in a different way, and you'll be amazed at what you start to see.
I invite you to look at Laura's website, theoutsideinstitute.org. There's some wonderful photographs there. I saw one photograph, I think it's the second one down on the homepage, or third. Is that some kind of a butterfly?
What is that? Oh, that's a Luna moth.
Oh, a Luna moth.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That was something.
You were talking about different cosmetics that you could make with some of these plants. And is there a toothpaste you can make?
Well, sure. There's all kinds of things that you can make for all parts of the body, because obviously, you know, Johnson & Johnson wasn't around when the indigenous people were here.
I thought they were.
You can take a birch twig. That's a really great thing to chew on and use to clean your teeth, and it has a delicious wintergreen flavor. But most all of the plants have multiple uses for us, some medicinal, some culinary. There's jewelweed, which is wonderful for itches, and poison ivy.
Exactly, poison ivy. I heard jewelweed, if you touch poison ivy and you get it right away, it just kills it off.
It really works.
Yeah.
Plantain, another really common plant that grows everywhere, is wonderful. You just chew up a leaf, make a little poultice out of it. If you get nettle stings, you can rub it on there. If you get a splinter, it's really helpful for extracting a splinter.
It extracts a splinter, the plantain?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it works really well.
Is that plantain that looks like the bananas? Is that the
same?
No. It's a different
plant. No, it's a green plant.
Right.
We call it a weed, but it's...
Is just a plant you haven't been friends with yet.
Exactly. Weeds have bad reputations, but they're really good.
Well, you found this little plant. I think we were growing it. The one that if you chew it, it's almost like pop. In the old days,
Spilanthus.
There was something called pop. I forget what they call it.
Pop
rocks or something, and it kind of explodes in your mouth.
Oh, cool!
I grew that last year.
I know that as something that's really good for if you put that on when you've been bit by a tick.
Oh, really?
Spilanthus
really?
Is supposed to be really helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it kill the tick?
I mean, it's used in Lyme protocol and for tick bites. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I learned something new. Besides the explosion in your mouth.
Oh, I'd love to try that.
Oh, you haven't tried that?
No,
Oh, well, I'll have to get you some this year. I got the signal. We're going to take a short break. You've been listening to the Catskills Renaissance Show. My name is Rio. My co-host is Lee Criso. And our special guest today is Laura Silverburn. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to the Catskills Renaissance, a show that aims to introduce you to all that is unique and interesting in this incredibly beautiful and relatively unspoiled area of New York State, which is Sullivan County and the Catskills. Our guest today is Laura Silverman. She's a naturalist, among other things. And just as we were...
Among other things?
Well,
that can
you know,
be taken a number of ways.
Well... I know our listeners aren't taking it in any negative way.
I'm just checking.
While we were on the break, we kind of got into a little conversation on Lyme disease. Then I had mentioned that my partner had Lyme disease and was able to heal himself completely with using natural methods. He,
right.
he never took a drug, even though when you went originally to the doctor, he had prescribed something.
But right, and they say anyway that if you take the antibiotics, it's only good for once. And if it doesn't do anything for it, you have to find a natural way to deal with it anyway.
Oh, okay.
Well, they could try to sell you more drugs, but it won't do anything.
Right. So then Laura was saying something about...
I was just able to listen to two really interesting podcasts on a show called Ologies. And there were two different scientists. One was interviewed about ticks themselves, and the other one was interviewed about tick-borne diseases. And I learned a bunch of stuff. Having had Lyme myself and taken the doxycycline, I recently tested positive for two co-infections, which apparently is a very common. Now ticks are not carrying just Lyme, but they're carrying, you know, up to a dozen other spirochetes that you can be infected with. And I have Borrelia and Babesia. But fortunately, if you're able to work with a good herbalist, there are herbal protocols out there to heal you. It's just really important to pay close attention to your body. There's a lot of hysteria around ticks now, I think. And, you know, it's definitely important to be informed and aware. But, you know, the idea that you're not going to go out into the woods because you might get a tick is kind of like saying, I'm not going to go to New York City because I might get hit by a car. So these are things that we contend with regularly.
We usually say, I'm scared to go to New York City because I might get mugged.
I think that's more from the 70s.
Yes.
You're dating yourself. Yes.
Oh, well, I always date myself.
No, I dated you.
That's true. You did date me.
So, Lee, tell us what kind of herbal remedies that you use to heal yourself.
Well, I used the
and how long it took.
Okay.
During the time that, you know, after you went to that doctor and was told that you had it, I did some research and I found somebody that said pine pollen was great. So you've been taking
right.
that.
So I was taking the pine pollen, the powder. For some reason, it just didn't seem to agree with me very well. With
and then I got you
nauseous.
The tincture.
Right, you got me the tincture, and that seems to really work fine. And I take that, and then there's two versions of an herbal mixture, and I don't have the bottle in front of me, so
oh, okay.
I don't have all the ingredients, but that seems to help out. And then I take echinacea. That just is a good general for, you know, to keep your immune system up. And also the astragalus,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I
right.
take that. And that seems to... Just that combination seems to work.
But you don't take it for... You took it for about what? Almost a year?
I took it for almost a year. And also, I had colloidal silver. I had a couple of...
drips?
Yeah, a couple of colloidal silver drips and vitamin C drips.
Mm.
So
anything
that I could think of to boost the immune system.
Right.
Right. Nice. We have a local fungus here called reishi that's also... Wonderful. You can make a tincture with it, and it's hugely immune boosting. It also has just like adaptogenic benefits that help your body regulate itself, whatever
right.
is going on. Yeah.
Right. Can you explain a little bit about those adaptogenic plants? Because to me, it seems like they're thinking plants. Because they come into your body, and let's say you're low in something or high in something, they just they do what they need to do to make it normal.
Yeah,
how do they
yeah.
do that?
I don't
Are
know.
They thinking plants?
You know, I'm not a trained herbalist. I don't really know how they work.
Oh.
They're AI plants.
AI.
they're NI, nature's intelligence, not artificial
yes.
intelligence.
That's right.
Well, that's what we're trying to
harness.
Yes.
In whatever
life.
Way we can. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. There's so much out there. Like Laura says, it's just amazing. And sometimes you could be looking at something and you're not seeing it. How, you could be staring at it and not see it. When do you actually see it? Something has to happen with a person.
I think, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because it's an endless process of learning. You know, I'll never know everything about the natural world. None of us will, because it's always changing and evolving, but also because it just takes a really long time. You know, I know a fair amount about plants and trees now, but I'm only just starting to learn about ferns and mosses and lichens. And, you know, it's really just a lifelong pursuit. And I think that it's like with anything, it's persistence and perseverance. And the more you expose yourself, one time you go out and you see one plant, and then you get to know that. And the next time you go out and you see that growing by that plant that you now know is another plant that you haven't yet met. And things just reveal themselves to you over time.
Right.
Are you familiar with goutweed?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we have an interesting goutweed story. You want to tell it?
Well, on a walk with Wild Man, he took us to a park. Inwood Park?
Inwood. In Queens, New York. Yeah.
No,
in
not
New
York, in Queens.
Near Washington Heights.
Right, yeah. And there's a big place there with goutweed. And I really became fascinated with goutweed because it has, like, when you stress it a little bit, it has such a wonderful smell to it. Lee puts it in salads, but I like it better in smoothies or something because it just blends in. Mm-hmm. It gives you all the nutrition of goutweed, and you don't have to worry about chewing it because it's not really that good for salad. But anyway, we went up there one day, and we did what you're not supposed to do. We dug up a little bit. And we brought it up here, and now I have all the goutweed I want.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, you know, that plant is actually considered quote-unquote invasive, so I think you're fine to dig that up and transplant it if you want. It'll spread and take over your whole garden.
It hasn't, because we've kept it more in check in one area.
It would, though.
It would if I let it. I'm sure it would.
Yeah, that's been...
Yeah, it comes up all the time, yeah.
Also called bishop's weed. It's considered what they used to call a pot herb, which basically means just something that's good as a cooked green.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Since you don't cook, though, smoothies are probably a good way to go.
Right. And also what I find with the goutweed is it gives a lot of energy. It gives the energy almost like, well, I can't drink coffee because then I have too much energy. I mean, then I'm awake for a week, so I'm like one of those people that are sensitive. But I get a lot of energy from the goutweed. It's amazing.
Sure. You know what else gives amazing energy? Not like caffeine, but just like a really powerful but steady support is chaga, which is another fungus that grows up here on birch trees. Yeah.
So you teach how to identify these different reishi and chaga.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I guess what you find depends on what season it is, what time of the year, what month.
And what ecosystem you're in. Different things grow in different places.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be very resistant to calling my walks foraging walks because I felt like it unfairly raised people's expectations about what you might find when you go out, because it's really an unknown.
Right.
Things can vary so wildly, and even if I scout a walk the day before, an animal could come in and eat whatever it is I had my eye on, so you're never quite sure. And also taking groups of, you know, a dozen people out, it's not really realistic or sustainable that everyone would go home with a big bag full of stuff for dinner. So,
But
foraging is a real sort of trendy buzzword at the moment, and if that encourages people to come get outside, then I will use it as bait.
Right. And you also do classes on how to make these tinctures with different things that you find?
Yeah, here and there I do that. Both at my home, I have a screened-in porch, and that's where most of my workshops are held, and sometimes at other places around the county and in the Hudson Valley, too.
Oh, that's great. And one thing that intrigued me that I saw on your website, you have fermented milkweed blossom. What is that? I have a lot of milkweed because I grow milkweed to support the monarchs.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So what, I mean, I have, milkweed is something that on a raw diet, I make the exception, like, to have it because you're not supposed to eat the blossoms raw. So you have to...
You can't eat any part of it raw, actually. You've eaten the flowers cooked?
Yeah.
The flowers? The flowers, blooming flower?
The blooming flowers and the buds, both.
Right.
Both.
Yeah, they're delicious.
I've never cooked the flowers. I use those to make a natural... I make a lot of natural flower ferments to drink. Because I do a lot of cocktail pop-ups and botanical mixology, and I bartend at the Stick It In once a month. And so the fermented flowers, they're almost like a kombucha in a way, but because there's wild yeast on the flowers, you don't need to use a mother. So you just take the I use linden flowers, milkweed flowers, I use pineapple weed, I use lilacs, I use black locust blossoms. Rose petals, you can ferment pretty much any flower.
Wow.
You just put them like in a big glass jar with some sugar and water, sometimes a little lemon zest, and then you just leave it. And the wild yeast on the flowers eats the sugar and causes fermentation and carbonation. The longer you leave it, the more tart it gets, and it's really delicious.
Wow.
So, milkweed is maybe my favorite one, though. It has an incredible flavor.
Approximately how long would you leave it? A week, 2 weeks?
It depends on the ambient temperature. So when it's hotter, it ferments a lot faster. But it's usually about 4 days to between 4 and 10 days, I would say.
Mm. Wow.
Could we get arrested for making milkweed booze?
It's not actually alcoholic. It might have like a tiny percentage of alcohol, kind of like kombucha does. But it's not an alcoholic beverage.
Wow, that really intrigued me. I'm going to go home. I think I still have some milkweed flowers there. Yeah, I'm going to.
Yeah, so I cut the flowers off the stems, you know, because you want to avoid as much of the latex as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Just the tips, you mean?
Just the actual little individual flowers.
Okay.
Yep.
And just use them. And let's say for a 2-quart jar, how many flowers? A cup? 2 cups?
I would use 2 cups of sugar, 6 cups of water, and like about 30 flower heads.
Okay. I'll be making that. Thank you, Laura. Sure. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You've been listening to Catskills Renaissance. My name is Rio, and my co-host is Lee Criso. Stay with us. We have one more segment. Welcome back. You're listening to the Catskills Renaissance, a show about all things unique and interesting in the Catskills. And today we have Laura Silverman with us. She's a writer, a consultant, a founding naturalist of the Outside Institute. That's theoutsideinstitute.org. We can get a lot of information. There's a calendar of events so you can find out what's coming up. She runs events all seasons, so even in the winter, even in the snow, there's something happening.
For all seasons.
And then she's also on Instagram. What's the address on Instagram?
At the Outside Institute.
At the Outside Institute on Instagram. Okay, I'm not that familiar with Instagram, but I'm going to look for it. Do you have to be on Instagram to get on Instagram?
You do.
You have to have an account.
But you are on Instagram.
Oh, that's right. I have 300 people that
are following you. Who knows why they follow you?
Yes.
They just like your picture.
I guess I'll just keep collecting people, but maybe one day I'll put something up there. So I invite you to go to theoutsideinstitute.org and look at the calendar of events and see what's coming up. And Laura, just in the last segment, touched upon that she once a month she's at the Stick It In, which is here in Berryville, New York. She does explain what you do.
Oh, I'm a guest bartender there, and I bring with me all my elixirs and potions and natural ferments and mix up cocktails and non-alcoholic drinks too for people that would like to have some wild tastes. This time I'll probably have a milkweed blossom cordial, fermented pineapple weed, maybe some black locust flower, some fermented rose petal. I use sweet fern, all kinds of local wild plants to make cocktails?
Lee, put it on our calendar. We're coming August 2nd, Friday. What
I'll
time?
I'll put it on the calendar.
6 to 10.
Six to 10.
As long as there's no poison ivy elixir.
Actually,
no, but we know that
imbibing
the
a small amount of poison ivy could actually make you immune to getting the itchy.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. And tell us about jewelweed. That's the antidote, right?
Oh, jewelweed is a local plant that's great to rub on poison ivy. Yeah.
So you just take a bunch of the jewelweed. You
it has really juicy stems. Mm-hmm. So jewelweed, you'll notice it has almost translucent fat stems that are filled with a liquid, and you want to break that open and rub the liquid on you.
Right, know? And then it would dissipate the...
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I had an experience once when I was weeding an area of my garden that had daylilies in it. And so I was happily weeding away. And then Lee and I took a trip to California. And when we got to California, all my arms were like just... with a rash, and I said, well, where did this rash come from? And when I got back to New York, I went back to the daylilies, and that's when I noticed the poison oak.
Poison ivy, yeah.
Poison ivy.
Poison oak is in California, though.
Yeah. But don't we have poison oak here?
No.
Oh, no, just poison ivy.
That's right.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. Oh, interesting. So, yes, that jewelweed is an antidote, but... it was too late for me. Now, is it too late when the rash already appears?
No. I think you can use it anytime. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Laura, you also provide something unique, which is field guides. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So last year we published our first field guide to the Upper Delaware and Hudson Valleys, and that was the summer volume. And this year we came out with the spring volume, and they're both still available on our website. I co-authored these with our naturalist at large, Jillian Rappaport, and we commissioned two different illustrators to work one on each volume. And they're really beautiful, simple, accessible publications, great for beginning naturalists, I would say. And unlike other field guides, they're not super crammed with Latin and botanical terms. They're really an easy read, and we include information that most field guides don't, like whether or not the plants are edible. We have some recipes in there. We talk about how they can be used in crafts, in cooking, in medicine. So it's a nice way to start developing a relationship with local plants.
Wow, I think.
And we also include information on some animals and birds in there as well.
Wow, that sounds good. And can you give the price on this?
Yeah, they're $25 each, and
very reasonable.
Yeah, they're for sale in
on our website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And also in some stores around the area in the Catskills primarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And in New York City, if anyone's listening, they're at Hauser and Wirth Gallery. They're at Flower Power in the East Village.
I know Flower Power. Yeah, I've
been there. And where else? Were you going to say something?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you also, through this, the institute of that you created, you do wild foods cooking and preservation?
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
Well, I sell some of my products. I have a ramp salt that I sell that sells out very, very quickly.
Ramp? A salt made from ramps?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. It's delicious, oniony, umami-rich salt. And I make a wild mushroom salt, and I make a few other products for sale. But I also sometimes do dinners in the area. I did a dinner series last summer, 6-course tasting menu featuring a lot of wild ingredients. And I like to, you know, when I teach a foraging class, generally we spend part of the time in the field and then part of the time back at the house learning how to preserve and cook with some of the ingredients that we harvest.
Right.
Yeah.
About wild foods, do you feel... Tell us the difference between wild foods and cultivated foods.
Well,
some of the major ones.
Yeah,
anyway.
Sometimes there's no difference at all, but oftentimes, well, for one thing, wild foods often are offering us a different flavor than anything we've ever had. And the flavors can often be more intense, and so can the nutritional value. You know, a lot of our cultivated foods are bred for sweetness or bred for to be more enduring. And wild foods can be both more flavorful and more fragile and more nutritionally rich. Ramps, for instance, which have become super popular, have a very pungent, oniony flavor that's kind of like leeks and garlic combined, but mm-hmm. really quite unique. Right. And, you know, you've eaten milkweed. It has, you know, a taste like nothing else.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I find that wild foods, well, I encourage people to identify and eat wild foods. You know, they have to be safe, though. But if they 100% identify them when they eat these wild foods, I think they're better for people's health than cultivated foods, because wild foods have to survive on their own, and they do. Most of the weeds in my garden are wild foods that I can just pick, and like purslane or lamb's quarter, and those foods just seem to survive anything. Like, for example, right now in one of my little greenhouses, I have a whole bunch of purslane that sprouted up, and there wasn't even any water there over the whole winter.
Yeah.
And the purslane came into this dry soil.
Sure. Yeah, wild plants are very hardy. They're super rich in antioxidants a lot of the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So I my belief is that they transfer some of that hardiness to us. Lee, I see you looking at me.
No, I was going to say then the groundhogs come to eat them.
Except they're not eating that. They're eating my cultivated vegetables.
Well, I'm looking forward to finding a chicken mushroom.
Oh, okay. We'll have to...
So if Laura spots any, she's got to, she has to let me know.
They're bright orange, so they stand out.
I will be on the lookout.
With the wild foods, do you have any special recipes that you make regularly or occasionally, or when you find them?
Yeah, I happened to be going for a walk yesterday. It was pouring rain, and I just put on my rain hat, my rain jacket. I didn't take a bag with me, which is, you know, really unusual, but I thought, I'm just going to go for a quick walk. I'm probably not going to find anything in this rain. And sure enough, I came across a beautiful flush of chanterelles, which is one of the most prized edible mushrooms. And I had to take my hat off and put them in my hat. So I got drenched, but it was worth it. And I love to make just a simple pasta with chanterelles will be wonderful. I like to make mushroom soups. I love to eat, you know, the shoots in the spring, the milkweed shoots, and I love to eat the milkweed blossoms. I love to fry the milkweed pods, like tempura them and fry them.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it really, I work with whatever is out there. Last year, for the first time, I harvested just tons of wild cherries, which are pretty astringent. You know, you're not really going to pop those in your mouth. They're quite sour and a bit bitter, and there's really not that much meat on them. They're a lot of pit. But I put them in vodka, and they made the most delicious almond-scented, cherry-flavored vodka ever. So right. That's great for a drink.
And what did I hear that those cherries, those tart cherries, are good for? What is it? Joint pain? Is it?
Good for gout, actually.
Oh, for gout.
Yeah,
for gout.
Yeah,
that's what it is. Yeah. Well, so gout is a form of joint pain, isn't it?
Yeah.
But except in the toe, right? Mostly.
It's in joints, yeah. People get in their knees.
Oh,
yeah.
They do? Mm-hmm.
It's in a lot of inflammation.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so those tart cherries are good for that.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that about sour cherries. I never heard anyone using wild cherries, but I imagine probably, yeah.
Interesting.
But where do you find the wild cherries?
On a wild cherry tree.
Oh. So you have to be
I walked into that one.
So you have to be able to identify it.
Yeah.
Right. I would tell you my secret spots, but, you know, I'd have to kill you.
Yeah. I think I'll pass.
Another thing that I really love are the black walnut trees, and I use the green walnuts when they're still soft to make bitters. It's kind of a version of an Italian liqueur called Nocino. where you slice the green walnuts in half and you steep them in vodka with some spices and a little sugar. It's absolutely delicious.
So are you meaning the green part that's outside the black
walnut? The whole
walnut?
Immature nut before it develops its hard shell and the husk turns black. When they're young, sort of about mid-June is the ideal time. Late June, it was a little bit later this year.
We have not gotten one nut. We have, for years, we have all these different nut bushes.
We have hazelnuts.
The squirrels do not even leave us one.
Oh. I'm thinking of putting some kind of canopy over.
Right.
I'll leave them two trees and then put canopy over the rest so we can finally get some.
Yeah.
Because right now it's full of hazelnuts, but, you know, as soon as they're ripe, they're gone because they work nonstop, those squirrels.
They sure do.
They're workers. Laura, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I hope that our audience can get a feel if they want to come up for the weekend or if you live up here. Go to theoutsideinstitute.org, look at their calendar events and see what's coming up, because I certainly will, and I'll be seeing you on some of those walks and definitely on August 2nd. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Catskills Renaissance. We hope you join us again. We're going to try to do a show once or twice a month and bring you all the unique and wonderful things that are happening up here in the Catskills.